Great having them, the fine provost, Kane University, and for so many years doing his thing over at Baruch, and the great David Birdsell joins us here on a Wednesday morning. Sir, and a very good morning to you. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks, Jay. Good morning to you.
Great having you. So much to talk to you about. I guess, you know, and he said a couple of things prior, David, regarding Columbia and all that's going on there. Mike Johnson is scheduled to check in and give some sort of a dissertation to the students there. We'll have a presser later on. It's absolutely despicable what's going on around this country right now. I say bring in the National Guard already to clean up this crap. I'll tell you, excuse my French, but I'm being kind too here on the radio. But in essence, I think at this point, I can't figure out why we're messing around in the wrong way. One fine swooparoo here, get the National Guard in, start at Columbia, go to NYU, then head over to Yale, clean up the remnants over at Cornell, at Harvard as well, get rid of some of these presidents. You know, enough of this. These donors and everything else have to be aware. Enough is enough, including Congress, by the way. Give me a sense of what you're feeling here.
Well, you're seeing a lot of donor pressure at all of the institutions that you mentioned, and the presidents at many of those institutions, not all of them, are under great pressure as a result. Look, I don't envy the position that they're in. They have students who have strong feelings, and let's be clear, the vast majority of whom among the protesters are peaceful, but you also have people, pardon me, from off campus who are sometimes coming onto these campuses who are very frequently, and this is the case right now at Columbia, surrounding the campus area in Morningside Heights, who are not students and who are much more inclined to the kind of volatile and hateful expressions that are not absent inside the quad, but they are far more prevalent outside the quad. And I think it's important for all college administrators, and look, all of us care first and foremost about the safety of our students. And I know that there's a huge controversy right now about exactly how we define that. But at the most basic terms, making people safe. And so bringing in armed forces, people with assault weapons, in cases where there is not at the stage at which they are called in, a violent confrontation is an invitation to repeat Kent State. So I wouldn't go down that road at this stage. But what you do have is a very, very clear set of political challenges that is particularly difficult for the Democratic Party right now. And that's one reason why you have Speaker Johnson interested in pursuing these investigations, why Virginia Fox's committee in the House, which seats at least Stefanik from New York, who had that famous confrontation with the presidents of Penn and Harvard at the end of 2023, that they want to exploit the fissures that are much deeper in the Democratic Party between people who are, most of them young, often disaffected with the political system, very unhappy with Israel's performance in Gaza. And then, of course, a very, very solid, and I mean, the most Jewish voting registrants in the United States are registered Democrats. And many of those are still ardently supportive of Israel. So this is clearly a fissure that's ripe for exploitation. And I think that we will see every effort made to exploit that fissure over the course of the coming 5 months.
David, why do you think that these presidents of these elite colleges act as they do? You know, the Manusha Figs, the Claudine Gays. Why do they feel their approach is kind of the right way of not fully condemning what's going on here? Is that an excerpt of the higher ups and being allowed to navigate in that type of way? Why is that?
I would say it's financial pressure, political pressure, and the clash sometimes that those two things offer with fundamental commitments of the academy. Let me start with that last piece, and this is by no means clean. I'm not trying to say that that universities always behave in the right way in this regard, but universities will always say that they are committed to free speech and that they are committed to a principle of academic freedom where their faculty would be allowed to they write, research, pretty much whatever they wish to do in the pursuit of truth as they understand it. And there are many, many times throughout American history that we know that academic expression as well as more popular expression has been repressed for political reasons. So the university always understands itself as a refuge against those kinds of assaults on free expression. You know, that said, and I want to bracket this and I'll get there in a moment, there has been a lot of controversy about efforts to police speech, particularly along the lines of inclusive language, gender pronouns, et cetera, in the last 20 years or so, and particularly in the last 5 years. But let me go back there in a moment. But the core commitment is one of these values that pervades the academy. And if you saw the American Association of University Professors, the AAUP, which is a big organization protecting faculty free speech and often performing quasi-union functions for faculty across the country, they condemned NYU on free speech grounds, and the same for Manu Shafiq at Columbia. So that's pressure number one, and that pervades the faculty, that pervades the students and the faculty organizations across the country. Pressure number two is to keep the fundraising spigots on. And this is particularly a particularly acute need at private institutions, but I want to be very clear, it's an acute need at public institutions as well. And I think less well appreciated in the Northeastern United States, where we have pleasure to be, but much more common elsewhere in the United States, is that your major public institutions raise billions of dollars, close to $20 billion for the University of Michigan, over $15 billion for the University of Virginia, and I could go on. There are no endowments of similar size in the Northeastern United States, but we're getting there with SUNY Stony Brook and a couple of others. But they can't make their books balance if they don't have those trustees happy and contributing. The trustees, needless to say, are older than the students. They tend to have different political points of view, and trying to keep them happy while also keeping the students happy is a very, very difficult thing to do. Finally, let's toss the politics in there. That right now, universities, along with almost every institution in the country, if you look at the Gallup polls going all the way back to the Eisenhower administration, have less public confidence right now than at any point in the past. And part of that is a result directly of the kinds of political controversies that we're talking about. But part of it, too, is that many people believe that there is a privileged class that gets to go to university and there is a class that doesn't, and that universities feather their own nests at the expense of necessarily public benefit. And we have moved away in this country, if we think about public universities, from investing in universities that make them inexpensive enough to attend without financial aid, and now casting into the private benefit where you go deeply into debt, not as much so as you would at a private institution, but in debt even to attend a public. Last point on that one, and this is a personal story. I went to the University of Virginia, and I graduated there in 1979. I'm old. But when I enrolled as a first-year student at the University of Virginia, tuition was $680. And I made that $680 mowing lawns in the summertime the year before. That's impossible for somebody who wants to attend UVA today. And that's the kind of split that you see creating the fertile ground for arguments about the academy. And that's why these presidents are in such a tough bind.
Yeah. And listen, good points. Good points. But, you know, again, a lot of what's going on, I think, of these organized groups, I don't think it's as many in-house students that are leading the pack here. You know, I want to make that pretty clear.
I totally agree with you on that.
Yeah.
Totally.
Let's make that pretty clear. But I still think it's an obligation of a university leader, okay, to set a tone here. And that means even with the presidents of these colleges to do their business in a proper way. When you hear debt to America chants, that's total condemnation right there, okay? There shouldn't be any fine line. To me, there shouldn't be a fine line at all in knowing how to address it. And that's my only problem with all this. And thus, when I say bring the National Guard, you're clearing out these organized groups, okay? You're clearing them out. And that's what they are, David. So that's why I stated that. I don't have a problem with that. I do agree. Listen, Kent State and everything else, if you're around, we never want to see that, ever. But in this particular situation, you know, I mean, this is permeating now, not only through the elite colleges, all the colleges as well throughout the country. Got to be stopped. Dave Birdsall with us. David, $95 billion went to the Senate for signage, now goes to the president. He'll sign that today. Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan all taken care of there. Mike Johnson getting a lot of heat from the Marjorie Taylor Greens and company out there. I stated earlier, you got to get it done. You cannot let Ukraine go dormant right now. They are in dire straits. If you don't do anything, Putin wins. I mean, that's the bottom line here, folks. Israel needs help. Taiwan. Let's not forget Taiwan and China. I think it had to be done. I get it with the southern border. I get it. I think the only way to fix the southern border, I think, is with a new leader. We'll see what happens there. But all in all, David, I felt that it had to be done and signed in a bipartisan way. Give me your sense.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that the bipartisan character of support for this package is ample testimony to the fact that most people believe this, irrespective of their party affiliation. There is a very noisy core of people, numbering about 20 in the House, who are opposed to one or another, or to all aspects of the bill. And there's another group of about 80 that would be opposed to one or another of the aspects of the bill, but felt safe in voting against it to please a base when they knew that it had the votes, even among their own caucus, to pass. This was, as you say, absolutely vital. Ukraine could not have lasted the year without this funding. This will not provide enough weaponry to give them a margin of victory, but will certainly, and it is calculated very precisely, to keep them in the game while they rebuttress their forces over the course of the balance of 2024, perhaps with an eye to doing something more adventurous to claim back territory in early 2025. There's also a lot of air support in this package, and now we can begin to see the promise of American F-16s, not American-owned F-16s, American-made, but most of them leased from Germany and other countries, actually entering the sky with Ukrainian pilots at the helm. And that's going to change the air game significantly, which matters because, of course, every night you're seeing Russian bombardments of Ukrainian positions. I think you're absolutely right. We know the Israel aid, and we just talked about some of the controversies over that, and we can talk about that in a moment. But the Taiwan piece is important, too, reminding the Chinese that the United States has not forgotten Taiwan. And this is sort of a double-barreled warning to Xi Jinping that, yes, we can ultimately get our act together and protect an ally in Ukraine. So the costs of incursion are high. And by the way, we're going to start making those investments or continue making those investments. We've been doing it for decades, but in real time now in Taiwan as well. So this was a very, very important bill. And last, on Marjorie Taylor Greene, she seems finally to have lost the support of conservative media, with the New York Post putting in a front page photo of her in a Russian military hat, calling her Moscow Marjorie, other Murdoch organs calling her Mayhem Marjorie. And I mean, across the board condemnation for the stand against this bill and the willingness to vacate yet another speakership. So the tide may be turning on the dysfunction and the toleration in the conservative media sphere of the level of dysfunction that we've seen over these past.
I know one thing, David, I can't tolerate Taylor Greene anymore. I really can't. They should vacate her post already. Enough is enough. I mean, her extreme stances is really not good for this country. You know, it's only a one lane highway, one way highway for her. It's her way or no way. You know, now she wants to get rid of Mike Johnson. I would ask her, well, what did you have against Kevin McCarthy? Wait, what do you want from a Speaker of the House? We're crying out loud, Marjorie. What would you like? What would you like? I mean, do you want Putin to kind of run his way in the West? Really? Do you want Israel to be completely eradicated by Hamas and Iran? I mean, what is it you want? I get it. We all want the border to be fixed. We all want it. And I feel the border will not be fixed until we get a new president. I mean, that's really the way it is. There's no other way. But I got to tell you, I am so sick and tired of seeing her left and right. My goodness, you know, her behavior during the State of the Union address and everything else. I mean, what goes on here? There used to be a time where we had some sort of semblance of decorum in this country from leaders, so-called leaders. We don't have any when it comes to Taylor Greene. Get her out of there.
The loss of a basic sense of decorum, I think this isn't just a matter of being polite. It's a matter of reaffirming the importance of our civic institutions and recognizing that a member of the House of Representatives is not just a human being in that role. There should be respect and there should be a set of standards of behavior that accord with that role. And we have seen that fall apart from Joe Wilson yelling, "You lie," to Barack Obama in the middle of a State of the Union address. And, I mean, that's not the beginning of this, but that was one particularly acute and early manifestation to the kinds of antics that we see from a Marjorie Taylor Greene now. And substantively, on the Russian point, she does favor Russian victory in Ukraine. She's been very explicit about that. And the fact that we can have a sitting member of the House of Representatives, and she is not alone, actively plumping for Russian successes on the battlefield is a remarkable, remarkable development, particularly in the Republican Party, if you think about where this party was 40 years ago.
No doubt about it. She needs to go. Matt Gaetz needs to go. You know, think about the days of good old Tip O'Neill and Newt Gingrich, for that matter. You know, when we had decorum in the House, when that speaker position actually meant something of respect, no respect at all going on. These days, I'll tell you that much. Dave Bertzel with us a couple of minutes. Supreme Court hearing arguments. It's a high case, abortion rights case today. David will consider whether the hospitals have an obligation under the federal law to provide emergency abortions to women who are in medical emergencies. Several stories in recent months detailing the accounts of pregnant women in distress were denied the emergency care in states with outright abortion bans or restrictive laws. Biden was in Florida yesterday, a week before a restrictive abortion ban in that state goes into effect. This, to me, is a campaign issue to galvanize a lot of voters. I mean, this is, to me, this is what Democrats have to hang their hats on right now. But that's a whole nother issue. To me, it's a common sense approach. If somebody is in distress, I don't care which way the state goes. It's about saving a life here. It's about saving a life. Not only the unborn, but also the mother. We can't forget that. And these court law decisions and everything else, this is a common sense issue to me. If somebody's in distress where a life is on the line, well, guess what? A procedure must be done, David.
I could not agree more. And it's mind-boggling that we would think otherwise. Let me add one piece of complexity here. Yep. There are a number of these state laws that do create exceptions for, imminent risk of loss of life for the mother. But defining that and creating a possible legal risk for an OBGYN trying to make a decision about what to do at that moment creates delay, because you're going to call the hospital attorney, right? And, well, here are her vitals, and here's what we think is going to happen. Does this constitute, under the law, a permissible window of intervention? During which window, the woman could absolutely die. And this has happened now in many cases, both near, experiences that almost led to death and experiences that did. And so we have to think not only about the common sense approach that you talk about right now, but making sure that these laws are written in such a way to insulate medical staff from potential legal consequences when they are exercising their best judgment as physicians. And I'm not talking about malpractice, that's a different question. But this notion that you would be performing an illegal abortion, you know, if the heart rate is up at 165, but not if it's at 166 or something of that sort, you know, that can't be allowed to cloud doctors' judgments and their direct consideration of the patient's medical condition.
Yeah, 100%. Two more quick ones for you. We'll save Trump for last, but yesterday, and it was buried a little bit with all this stuff going on, but in Tennessee, lawmakers there, David, in the state of Tennessee, passing a bill that would allow teachers, K through 12, school staff as well, to be on. And those who seek to bring some sort of a handgun on school grounds, there's going to be conditions. You know, there's going to be conditions, you know, that you'll have to have an enhanced permit, background check, training, hours and hours, dozens of hours, among other requirements. Now goes to the governor's desk, who is a Republican, by the way, Bill Lee, I believe, his name. But listen, this has been a contentious debate, arming teachers. We know gun violence is still the leading cause of death for kids in this country right now. I gave the numbers before, but to me, I'm all for this. I'm all for it. You can have all the detectors you want, double lock the doors, side doors, and everything else. There's still a way for people to get in and do their business here. I think you have to protect these kids. That's the bottom line. We wait until the next one. I think the Tennessee situation, I hope it permeates throughout this country, but I think it's needed. Unfortunately, this is what we got to go through. If you arm a teacher, you keep a kid alive. That's what it could come down to here. What's your take?
Well, the question is how effective an armed teacher could be, and do we want the armed teachers to be holstered up from the moment they walk into class? I mean, imagine how that would change the dynamics of the classroom. That you're in kindergarten and your teacher is, you know, has a Glock on her hip. Is that what we're doing? How are we securing those guns when the teacher is distracted and dealing with another set of kids if the Glock is on her hip and one of the kids manages to fumble it open? You know, these are such easy scenarios to imagine. On the other hand, if we were to imagine that every classroom has a locked case with a weapon in the locked case, would a teacher be able to get to the weapon in time to make a difference in the case of a school invasion? And I ask those as practical questions. I think, you know, we've seen a very, very mixed record on the use of weapons for self-defense. They are much, much more frequently used in ways that were not intended. Either to inflict injury on someone who is not a gun-toting assailant or to commit suicide or to be involved in an accident. So, you know, what I would hope for is an environment where we did not have to weaponize our schools and to fortify our schools and return back to a period when guns were somewhat less available. And, you know, when you and I were in school and you could walk through the front door, they weren't chained or padlocked and there were no metal detectors. But we need a different society in order to make that a safe and practical possibility.
I agree, but I also want to keep kids alive. And yep. That's my biggest thing right now. Now, listen, there are a lot of mental health issues out there. I think we need more counselors, you know, with the budget and everything else. We'll get into that in another time with the state. You know, they still need to fortify personnel to handle the students and issues that go on a daily basis. But in betwixt and in between, I think we've got to arm these teachers. We have to. I mean, at this point, I don't want to report on another incident somewhere in which 10 kids have died. Enough is enough. I've had it, especially after what happened in Oxford, Michigan a couple of years ago with a kid killing four parents. You know, listen, held accountable and rightfully so there, but in essence, I don't want to see anybody die. And in my estimation, at least it could be some sort of a deterrence as far as somebody thinking about that. One last thing, only got about a minute, the Trump deal. And listen, you know, seven men, five women on the jury, advantage advantage Trump. I don't buy that for 1 second. It was quoted in Newsweek what I said. Listen, it's still the venue, which is New York, doesn't favor Trump. The favorability as far as the mindset to me doesn't favor Trump. Let's just fast forward and convict the man already and get rid of this circus. And let's move on. We got other priorities around here. But in essence, the beat goes on. The only reason why this guy is even standing trial is because of who he is. Give me a quick sense of what you're feeling.
Well, you know, clearly he's due his day in court, and he is going to be the trial will proceed. His attorneys have taken a very aggressive posture, not surprising there, but already earning reprimands from the judge. There may be a decision soon about contempt charges that the prosecution has recommended, and we'll see where Judge Mercan comes down on those issues. One of the questions here, and I'm sure that if there is a conviction in this case, that it's going to go to appeal, and there is virtually no chance that that appeal will be decided prior to the election in November. So this is going to remain, in some respects, even with a conviction, in some measure of legal limbo for at least months, if not years to come. So we'll see where that goes. And the immediate implications are the political implications. There's the question, and we know from repeated exposure that the most committed members of his base are not going to walk away from him in the event of a conviction. But there's the imagery that we see now every day on the television news, and there's another question about whether we should see it every day on the television news. But he makes his statement at the end of the day. He is clearly he's in a court, and like any other defendant in the court, he has to obey the judge's directives or face consequences. And it diminishes the kind of impression that Donald Trump wants to convey about always being in charge, always being on top. And he's clearly not, as no defendant could be in these kinds of circumstances. So that may weigh into how this plays out. And we've seen the crowd of supporters across the street in Foley Square diminish over the last few days down to a handful of people. So the ability at least to create the kind of physical presence appears to be, at least for right now, considerably diminished. And that may be one of the outcomes of this trial.
David, we'll keep an eye on things. Love having you on. Lots to talk about as always. And I look forward to the next time, my friend.
Me too. Thanks for having me, Jay.